And I'm joined on the phone right now by Stephen Zunes. He is a professor of politics and chair of the Peace and Justice Studies program at the University of San Francisco. He is the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, and serves as the Middle East editor for Foreign Policy in Focus. And he's joining me this afternoon to talk about the situation in Gaza. Hello, Stephen.
Hello.
Hello. So why don't we just jump right in here? Can you give us an update on the current situation in the Gaza Strip and the West Bank?
Well, I can't give too updated a report because I'm up here in Alberta at the Conference of the International Peace Research Association, and I've been at panels and plenaries and various other gatherings all day, but I think I assume it's not too different than what we've seen the past few days. Israeli forces are engaging in widespread collective punishment against the Palestinian population. They have destroyed bridges, a major power station in Gaza Strip. They have rounded up, arrested a number of officials of the Palestinian democratically elected government. They've bombed the offices of the Palestinian Prime Minister, and the United States seems to be determined to block the United Nations Security Council from doing anything about these serious breaches of international law.
What has been the U.S. response exactly?
It's been very muted, basically encouraging both sides to exercise restraint. You know, which implies a kind of symmetry between the two sides that really does not exist in this particular situation, not just in terms of firepower and the ability to do a lot of damage, but the cell that kidnapped the Israeli corporal, which precipitated many of these recent actions, was done by a group where it's not clear at all whether they, you know, how closely tied they are with the with Hamas or any other entity represented in the Palestinian Authority. And it also, of course, ignores that the fact that this kidnapping was in response to a whole series of Israeli attacks against civilian targets in the previous weeks. The United States, of course, is the major military, economic, and diplomatic backer of the Israeli occupation, and has been virtually alone in the international community in failing to condemn the Israeli offensive.
Well, there have... what would you say to the argument that there's been Qassam rocket attacks from Gaza on Israel, that this was a cross-border raid into Israel when the soldier was kidnapped, and that this is an act of war, and so therefore... You know, they have a right to respond the way the Israeli government does, the way they are.
Yeah. Well, certainly one could, you know, these Qassam rocket attacks are unnecessary provocations. While they have not killed any civilians, they certainly carry that risk, and there have been some minor injuries from these attacks. And that's certainly wrong, and of course, the kidnapping soldier was not a legitimate act of war either. At the same time, at most, you could say that Israel would have a right to, for example, bring in a commando unit or some kind of paramilitary operation if they knew where the kidnapped soldier was and rescue him, and if necessary, to kill some of his captors in order to do that. I think that would be within the bounds, I think, of what's, you know, generally recognized acceptable behavior. But this wholesale collective punishment is a clear violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention, to which Israel, as a signatory, is expected to uphold, and the United States, as a signatory, is obligated to try to enforce by whatever way we can. And again, as the primary backer of Israel, we certainly would have some leverage if we chose to do so.
What if... The argument that there are 9,000 Palestinian prisoners, many held without charge in deplorable conditions, and that these prisoners are also could be considered hostages or kidnapped. What of the 32 Palestinian elected leaders, at least 32, that were detained are now in Israeli jails.
It's certain, and that's a very important piece, actually. And I think those who, in Washington, who seem to take the situation of this one Israeli corporal, as unfortunate as that is, and ignore the plight of thousands of Palestinians who are also, in effect, being held hostage, I'd say are guilty of nothing less than racism. I mean, it assumes that somehow Israeli lives are more important than Palestinian lives. I think it should be emphasized that many of the Palestinian prisoners in Israel are guilty of terrorism and terrorist-related activities. Some are guilty of violence against Israeli soldiers in the occupied territories, which is not terrorism, but you know, it's certainly a violent act. One could, I guess, conceivably see them as POWs, if you will. But there are also large numbers of these prisoners who have not been charged, and according to human rights groups, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, as well as Israeli human rights groups like B'Tselem, Rabbis for Human Rights, and others, that these are innocent people. Many of them are children, and that they are indeed equivalent to the to hostages. They should not be in these prisons. They should be released. And the failure of the Israelis to recognize this, and the failure of the United States to recognize this, is essentially thumbing their noses at international legal norms to which they are obliged to uphold.
Now, there was going to be some kind of mediation. I believe the leader of Egypt was involved. Do you know what the outcome of that was, if there was any headway there?
Well, apparently, there have been some conflicting reports, and again, it's a little unclear who the Palestinian kidnappers are and who they're connected with, but there apparently were some proposals for some kind of prisoner exchange. The initial demands were simply for the women and children being held. It's been expanded to include others. The Israelis have refused to engage in such a quid pro quo, though there have been some cases in the past where the Israelis have released suspects held by Hezbollah, which is a Lebanese group, and Fatah, which is a secular Palestinian group. But it appears at this point, especially given the strong backing of the United States, Israel will be holding firm, and they've thus far rejected any of the offers put forward so far and have implied they would reject all such offers.
What is the significance of the recent news that Hamas has agreed to, I guess, sign on to a document that some prominent Palestinian prisoners had drafted, and Fatah was working on getting Hamas to agree to this, which would implicitly, though not directly, recognize the State of Israel by accepting a two-state solution? What is the significance of that, if any?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's been a pattern that's gone back since the 1970s, and most notably in the 1982 Israeli invasion of Lebanon, that these Israeli military offensives seem to come on the heels of diplomatic initiatives from the Palestinian side. It's debatable about how significant this document might be overall, but clearly this threat of moderation was not palatable to some Israeli officials. And it may be just coincidental. I'm not saying that this is deliberately designed to scuttle this initiative, but the timing certainly is not good if the Israelis really were interested in taking advantage of this of these concessions to the Palestinian side and the chances of a restart of the peace process. It should also be noted, of course, that the Israelis have refused to resume formal peace talks with the Palestinians, indeed, they have, and this is not just since the election of a Hamas majority in the Palestinian Legislative Council, but this has been the case since February of 2001, when the right-wing government was first elected. They even when President Abbas was in power, and he had, or he still is in power, but when he was in power with the backing of a Fatah majority in the Palestinian parliament, which was quite explicit in its support for a two-state solution and its commitment to the Oslo process and everything else, even then the Israelis were refusing to engage in substantive negotiations. And so it appears that while Israelis may have legitimate concerns about Hamas's ideology and legitimate concerns about the terrorist tactics by its armed wing, the Al-Qassam Brigade, that this refusal to negotiate appears to be more of an the nature of Hamas and its ideology and tactics seems to be more of an excuse than the reason for the stalling of the peace process.
There's been some speculation that this attack on Gaza might have been planned and been in the works for quite some time, and that this was just the trigger, the excuse. What do you think of that argument?
I don't think there's very little question that that's exactly the case. Indeed, the Haaretz, one of the three major Israeli daily newspapers, came out with an article a few days ago that described this in some detail. Indeed, the rounding up of the much of the cabinet and key legislators of a democratically elected legislative body is unprecedented to my knowledge, and and the efficiency in which the Israelis carried out these operations does indicate there was substantial pre-planning involved.
How does this all this activity of the Israeli government, the arrests of Palestinian elected officials, the bombing of power plants and bridges, effectively cutting off power and water, and the shutting down border crossings, effectively barring the importation of food, fuel, and other goods, these things, how is this behavior, is it in terms of international law?
Well, again, it's a matter of collective punishment that you cannot inflict this kind of harm on the civilian population as a whole because of the actions of even of a government, much less the actions of a armed guerrilla cell, which may not even for which the government may not even have control, that. This has been a standard tradition in international law that was indeed, even before it was formally codified, was used as part of the Nuremberg prosecutions at the end of World War II. International Court of Justice in International Court of Justice in a ruling 2 years ago. Reiterated that signatories of the Fourth Geneva Convention have an obligation to uphold them, and other signatories have an obligation to apply appropriate means to make sure that they are abided by. And it's and if Israel can continue to get away with this, it will be another of a series of unfortunate precedents that would weaken international humanitarian law. Quite while the Israeli government has the backing of some broad segments of the establishment political parties in pursuing this offensive, there are large numbers of Israelis, and ranging from, including actually military soldiers, reservists, and the like, as well as intellectuals who have been denouncing this offensive. At minimum as excessive, and in many cases as illegal. And it is that the United States has chosen not to raise the legal questions is yet a reminder of how removed Washington is from recognizing even the most basic of international humanitarian law.
What about on the other hand, the cross-border raid, the taking of the soldier, as you called him a hostage, I believe. The peace group Gush Shalom in Israel says he should not be considered a kidnapped soldier, but rather a prisoner of war. My last guest, Leila Haddad, was saying that the taking of the soldier was actually legal under international laws. He was a military, it was a military action or military target or something of that nature. What do you make of those arguments?
One couldn't make that case, I suppose. I'm a little dubious in the sense that it was not usually prisoners of war, those who are captured in the course of normal combat operations. The assault, which also ended up killing another Israeli soldier, may have been considered a soldier, captured on the battlefield or whatever. But there are some indications that it was a pre-planned kidnapping to try to get political leverage for something, and that I think crosses the line legally. But again, I don't know the exact circumstances of his capture to give a definitive verdict either way.
Israel is saying, the Israeli government is saying, that they have some clues as to where the soldier is being held. I'm wondering what you think might be the outcome. There's also been statements that the siege of Gaza, the lack of power and water, could last for several months. So what do you see as the possible outcome of the situation? I know it's kind of hard to predict.
So certainly there's a real humanitarian crisis that's been provoked by this, adding to the enormous human suffering since the U.S.-led sanctions against not just the Palestinian Authority, but a number of other Palestinian entities that help provide the basic needs of the population, which have suffered under nearly 40 years of foreign military occupation. The power plant that was blown up was ironically insured by the U.S. government at a time when there were some tentative steps towards supporting at least some degree of Palestinian self-determination. Since Israel invaded the Gaza Strip in 1967, they have tried to incorporate the Gaza Strip along the West Bank and the Golan Heights into Israel in as many ways as possible, economically and, of course, but also just in terms of the power grid. And having the Palestinians having their own power-generating station was an important step, both practically and symbolically, in terms of creating an independent Palestinian state. And by destroying this, the Palestinians have lost this both real and symbolic manifestation of their autonomy, and again has resulted in some serious humanitarian crisis, particularly because this power station is what runs the pumps that provide the water supply for the Gaza Strip, which is a heavily populated urban area, mostly refugees and their descendants who were expelled from Israel in 1948, and they have arid area in the summertime, and people need water.
It's very hot there right now, so. What do you think is the likely outcome if Israel's saying that they have some clues where the soldier might be? I wonder if what you were saying at the beginning about a commando raid or something like that would be possible here.
It's conceivable. They might. I think, though, in many ways, that this whole crisis that Israel has generated in its overkill is not really about the soldier, as we were talking about earlier. It does appear to have been pre-planned. So, frankly, I don't think the fate of this 19-year-old corporal is the highest priority for the Israeli government. And as a result, I don't see any immediate rescue effort. I think the real goal here is to oppress the Palestinians as much as possible. It sounds a little trite, but basically, what the Israelis have been doing in a number of those policies is to hope they can somehow beat them down to submission. But I think in reality, and history has shown this time and time again, that this just leads to a hardening of attitudes. It leads to a strengthening of Hamas and Islamic Jihad and other hardline elements which are not interested in peace. And just as Palestinian terrorist attacks have hardened Israeli attitudes, these kinds of Israeli actions are hardening Palestinians' attitudes, and therefore makes peace further and further out of reach. And I frankly don't think that the current Israeli leadership and the leadership in our own government that supports them are frankly interested in peace. I think they want to see Israeli domination, and are not interested in the possibility of a viable Palestinian state alongside Israel.
Well, I guess my last question is kind of moot if our government isn't interested in peace, in a sense, and if the Israeli government is in a similar has a similar attitude. But if we were truly interested in peace, then what would be the alternative solution, I guess?
Well, I mean, as I've said on your show before, I think the ultimately, what needs to happen is for the United States to take a position of tough love towards Israel, unconditional support for Israel's right to live in peace and security, but a refusal to give a carte blanche for the occupation and the colonization of the occupied territories, and to support for Israeli human rights abuses, and including the kinds of actions we've seen in recent days. In terms of the more immediate crisis, I think it's critical that we insist Israel pull back, release the civilian political officials they have seized, and be willing to suspend all economic and military aid until they do so, and to cooperate with other members of the United Nations Security Council in not just condemning the Israeli actions, but in fact imposing some kinds of sanctions if Israel refuses to abide by such demands that they uphold these international legal standards. I do not disagree with the U.S. position of not wanting to support Hamas's government, given the orientation of that group. But I think certainly insisting and facilitating where appropriate. An end to terrorist attacks and other provocative actions on the Palestinian side are important, but we must remember that even if one assumes that both Israeli Jews and Palestinian Arabs have equal rights to self-determination, peace, and security, we need to recognize the gross asymmetry in power between the Palestinians and their Israeli occupiers, and to recognize that the Israelis, as the occupying power, have a particular responsibility in resolving the conflict.
I'm speaking with Stephen Zunes. He's a professor of politics and chair of the Peace and Justice Studies program at the University of San Francisco. He's also the author of Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism, and he serves as the Middle East editor for Foreign Policy and Focus. Stephen, maybe we could wind up today. If you could just give people some ideas where they can get more information, where they can turn to inform themselves on the issues we've been talking about today.
Well, sir, there are a number of groups that are working on Israeli-Palestinian peace and are monitoring the current situation particularly closely. Activist groups like United for Peace and Justice, U.S. campaigns in the occupation, the Tikkun community, among others. For more general background on U.S. policy in the region, I would recommend the website for which I serve as Middle East editor, and that is the Foreign Policy in Focus Project, which is www.fpif.org. Again, that's www.fpif.org, Foreign Policy in Focus.
Thanks so much for joining me today, Stephen. Really appreciate you taking the time.
My pleasure.
Have a good evening. Bye. And again, that was Stephen Zunes. One of the websites he mentioned, fpif.org. That's Foreign Policy in Focus. FPIF.org to read more. He is the Middle East editor of Foreign Policy and Focus. And again, his book is called Tinderbox, U.S. Middle East Policy and the Roots of Terrorism.